You are listening to the Badass Lady Folk of Brooklyn here on Radio Free Brooklyn. I'm your host, Mari Pack.
And I'm Christine Stoddard, your co-host.
You are just listening to Toxic Moxie's Talking Hands. We are very excited because today we have with us our bae, Kaylin Kopisch, who is also our producer. Welcome.
Happy to be here.
So, Kaylin graduated from Virginia Commonwealth University, where she received her BA in English with minors in writing and Italian studies. It was there she told hundreds of people that no, she did not want to be a teacher. While in school, she was the executive editor for the university literary journal, Amendment, and interned for Blackbird, an online literary magazine. After graduating, she moved to New York City to pursue a career in publishing and editing, but is currently chained to a desk in a finance office. She has been published in Quail Bell Magazine and Minetta Review. So, Kaylin, why did you want to join our band of misfits and become our producer?
Well, first of all, you guys are awesome. So when you guys were doing a project, I was like, I just got to be a part of this.
Thanks, Bay.
Yeah, thanks, Bay. So good to hear. Very mutual feeling.
Yes. But yeah, no, I think you posted, Christine, on Facebook about how you were starting this radio show. And I've been looking since I've moved here to get into something kind of like this. I didn't know what it was going to be, whether it was going to be like a lit mag or like a radio show. And I've always been intrigued by radio. I've never wanted to work in it, but I've always liked radio. So when I saw her Facebook post on it, I was like, I'm just going to shoot her a message and be like, if I can help out. And now I'm like the booking producer.
I didn't say, now we like dragged you in. We're like, you want to help? Okay. Joke's on you because we know you're talented and useful.
You're going to have a real role, not just a like sign in and show up kind of role.
No, I was really excited when you guys like really pulled me in. I was like, oh, hell yeah. This is perfect. So, yeah.
So how do you usually choose your community projects? Because you, everywhere, so I've known Kaylin for, since I was 20? Like, it's been a while. Yeah. I'm 26 now. Mm-hmm. It's like 5 or 6 years. And you've always been really involved in a lot of community mm-hmm. projects. So how do you pick them?
So definitely since I've moved to New York, and it kind of sucks to say, but when you live here, you just have a zillion things to do all the time. You work, I work, I write, I go to a lot of shows, I hang out with friends, I try to keep up with people and stuff like that. I have some friends here, two really good friends that call me our group event planner.
You really are. No, very truly.
Because I just, like, send out the invites, and I'm like, this is what we're doing.
Like, I always know that if I'm like, do I want to do something on a Tuesday? Like, let's see what Kay's invited me to on Facebook.
So, yeah, because I do that, it's actually really difficult for me to commit to something in terms of, like, community service, which sucks, and I've tried really hard to, like, commit to stuff. So when I first moved here, I started doing New York Cares, which is a really awesome volunteer organization. It's like the biggest volunteer organization in New York, I think.
Wow.
Oh, yeah. Wow, nice. It's really nice because you basically join, you go to a really quick orientation, and then you sign up for stuff, and they have everything from like walking dogs for a dog shelter, which I did, which was super fun.
Oh, that's so nice.
And then I did like a kitchen once where it was like the homeless people came in and you like served them food, and that was awesome. And so I did one where we went to Harlem to an after school program and helped kids like write poetry. So I kind of like was doing all these different things, but then I couldn't ever commit to it because it was like once a week, usually during the week, and it just, I felt bad because I would sign up for stuff and then something would come up and I'd have to bail, and it just felt really bad about it. So
you're doing like the cafeteria style where you're like, when I have time, I'm gonna do
this.
Yeah,
exactly. Yeah. So one organization I found, which is awesome because they do have their set time, but you do not have to sign up. Like, it's just,
you just drop in.
Yeah, you literally just drop in. I didn't have to sign anything, which I thought was like I was like, okay, you guys trust me. But it's called Books Through Bars.
Oh yeah.
It's out in Red Hook, there's a bookstore called Freebird Bookstore, where they, in the basement, you basically read letters from inmates who are asking for books. You basically comb through the piles of books they have down there, and you package them up and you send it to them.
Aww.
Yeah, and so they have like 3-hour time slots on Sundays and like 3-hour time slots on Mondays, so I like try to go to those when I can. That's probably the one I've been most active in, but
How does that work? You read the letters, and do they request specific titles, or they just say, I like mysteries, and you find a mystery?
Yeah, it's kind of a little bit of both. There are some people that request really specific titles, and it's really, like, out there, and they just say, find something that you think that they would like. And it's pretty cool, because most of the people who go to that are readers, people that are very active readers, so they would know, like, kind of a good thing for the inmate to have. And then there are those that say, I just want a book on psychology. A lot of people want books on, like, learning a skill so that when they get out, they can do something with it. A lot of people saying, can I get a book on, like, electricity because I want to, like, become an electrician when I get out. A lot of people that are just trying to get their GEDs and stuff like that. So that's pretty cool. And then quite a few of them, like, art books a lot, like photography books. And there was one inmate that wanted horror books. And in his letter, he said he was at the peak of his fascination with horror. And I was like, I mean, all right. Like,
you're already in prison.
I felt kind of weird about that. But I was like, you know, he's got to read. Like,
yeah, you got to wonder what his crime was.
They don't say that. But a lot of the letters are really, really beautiful. Just saying, thank you. This, like, helps me get through everything. Yeah. And, like, this is going to help me educate myself a little bit. So when I get out, I can do something and not be stuck. And it's pretty cool. It's a cool organization.
Does anyone ask for books on law?
Yeah. A lot of people do, actually. And unfortunately, we don't have, like, a really great selection. And then another thing that we get a lot of requests for are graphic novels. Mm. We get a lot of requests for that. And we really don't have a lot. But actually, when I was there, one of the women who runs it, because people kept coming up to her saying, they want graphic novels. Where can I find the graphic novels? Mm-hmm. And she was like, just put those to the side, because apparently somebody donated, like, 15,000 graphic novels or something like that. Like, they just, I don't know if it's that high a number, but she said it was, like, just boxes and boxes of graphic novels that they donated.
Awesome.
Yeah, so we have, like, a ton of graphic novels to give the inmates, because that's something that they request a lot. So
how do you donate books to the organization?
I think you just go to Free Bird Bookstore and, like, drop them off. It's all very laid back. I was actually talking to one of the women who runs it, and she said she was trying to do inmate work, helping inmates, but the problem was her schedule was so busy, just didn't have time to do it, so she kind of started working with this organization, and it's all very laid back.
Well, it's kind of sticky volunteering at prisons for a number of reasons, mm-hmm. because there are security issues, mm-hmm. of course, and many of the nonprofits are religious, mm-hmm. and if you are religious, then you probably are happy to mm-hmm. do that, but if you're not a religious person, then you might not be too thrilled mm-hmm. about volunteering to a religious organization.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, definitely.
So this is a little bit of a tangent. Can you just address a little bit, because we're talking about religious stuff? So, side note, like, I think Kay's family is super cool, and I'm constantly fascinated by them, and they come up a lot in your work, too.
They do, yeah, they do.
Like, most of your writing references your siblings or your family, mm-hmm. but can you talk a little bit about your idea of religion based on, mostly your dad, is what it sounds like.
Yeah, so my mom was raised, I want to say Baptist. I haven't gotten a straight
some kind of Christian,
this.
You know,
some denomination of
one
Christian,
of them Southern Christian.
But she's, but I think today, I'm guessing that she would probably identify as agnostic mm-hmm. now. And so my parents did not raise me religiously at all. Like, we never went to church. My mom volunteered at churches doing daycare and stuff like that, so I was in churches a lot, but I never went to the church. I hung out with some of the kids there, but not that often. And then my dad, I guess I would say agnostic. I kind of get the feeling he's atheist, which is what I am. I'm atheist. So when just growing up with him, he kind of taught me to be very skeptical of organized religion and saying that it can do a lot of good, but can also be very dangerous and stuff like that. And so it was interesting growing up with just non-religious parents. And
which is,
like,
rare in the South.
Yeah. No, yeah, it is. So wasn't baptized. Don't have a lot of friends who weren't baptized.
And yet you are what I think some very religious communities would say is unusual. You are this person who is very interested in community, who's mm-hmm. very interested in good works, mm-hmm. but it comes from a completely a-religious place.
Yeah, no, it's true. My parents always taught me, you know, to be a good person, to help people when you can and stuff like that. My mom's a nurse, and my dad's, you know, always around to help people and stuff like that. And we've definitely, like, helped people in our past. I think one of the things that really showed me just how much it does to help somebody is when I was a kid, there was a woman that my dad knew through, I want to say through VCU, but it was definitely in Richmond.
Richmond is where you're from.
Yes, Richmond, Virginia. He knew her there. And I'm trying to remember the complete story because this was when I was very young. She was hit by a car, basically, really bad. It, like, shattered her hip, and she was homeless, basically, and my parents took her in. They let her,
really?
Yeah, they let her, like, live in a room in our house. We were living in Oregon Hill at the time, and they just, like, gave her a room and a place to stay and stuff, and she, like, got back on her feet, and now she's, like, an artist in Richmond, and we, like, wow. went to one of her art shows. So it was just kind of one of those things where it's, like, when I was a kid, it was just this woman living in her house. Like, right. my parents were like, she's just going to live here now. And I was like, okay, cool. And I didn't really think about it. And then when I got older, I realized, like, oh, my parents, like, took in somebody who was homeless.
Yeah.
Wait, how long did she live with you?
You know, it's, guess. I want to say a few months.
That's a long time to have a homeless
that's
person
so
in your home.
Yeah. Kind.
Yeah, I know. And that's kind of, like, how my parents are. They're just, like, one of those people who are like, oh, somebody needs some help, we gotta help them. Another thing they do is my mom always jokes that the basement of our home, which everybody should know this, the basement of our home is open to anybody who needs, like, a place to stay. My mom calls it the estrogen orphanage because of the number of wayward girls that she took in. So it started when a friend of mine from high school was in a really, really bad place. She had left home and was living with her grandmother, and then her grandmother kicked her out, and she basically had nowhere to go. So she called me and was like, I don't know what to do. Like, I have nowhere to go. And I hadn't spoken to this girl in, like, a couple years, mm-hmm. but she didn't really know who else to turn to. So I called my mom and told her, and my mom knew this girl from when we were younger, and my mom was like, without even, like, skipping a beat, my mom was like, give her our address. Like, mm-hmm. and she stayed with us for a few months in our basement. And then another friend of mine who was living in Richmond, and he's transitioned at this point, so he was a girl when this happened, but I'm going to say he was doing well, but there was basically a month gap in his lease, mm-hmm. and he was going to have to go home to North Carolina, but he had a job here, and he didn't know what to do, so I mentioned it to my mom, and my mom was like, yeah, there's plenty of room in the basement, so he lived in our basement for a month. And then my really good friend Maya needed a place to stay for a week while she was in Richmond. So at one point we had three people living in our basement.
The estrogen wayward orphanage.
And my mom was like, yeah, tell all your friends if they ever need a place to stay. Like, we've got a basement.
It's so funny to hear you talk this way, because one of the ways I think of you is being this person that, like, draws in a group of very, like, diverse people. Like, very, like, different ages, different backgrounds, mm-hmm. different personality types, and you go to your house sometimes, and you just look around, you're like, I would not guess all of these people would be in the same room, necessarily.
Yeah.
But that's, I can see you getting that from your mom.
Yeah,
she's just this person who's like, everybody comes in, and you're that way too.
Yeah, yeah, which is very funny, because when we're not bringing in people that need help, my family can be kind of secluded, though. Like, we definitely, like, I think my parents got internet this year for the first time. First time my family's ever had internet. So they're very, like, they are a little isolated in a way. Like, when we just hang out at home and, like, watch movies and do this thing. So if there isn't wayward children in our home who need a place to stay, we're actually, like, a little isolated, actually. So it's interesting.
Do you think that's why you love to read?
Oh, definitely. I mean, growing up as a kid, we would have cable when my parents could afford it. And I remember one day we came home, me and my sister both got really, really good grades on our report cards when we were in elementary school. And we just came home and the TV was on, and it was Fairly Odd Parents on cable. And my mom had a note stuck to the TV that said, good job on your grades, guys. And she got us cable for, like, a little while to, like, for that summer, basically, to, like, you'd be like, yeah, you did a good job on your grades. But definitely, I think the main reason I like to read is I did have asthma when I was a kid. Mm-hmm. And so I could go outside. I definitely went outside and played and, like, rode my bike and stuff. But I was a lot less active than my friends. And I would have to sit on our couch and do this fucking nebulizer. It was the worst thing ever. It's basically a mask you stick to your face, mm-hmm. that, like, blows medicine down your, like, into your, yeah, lungs, and you have to inhale it. Yeah, to save your life. So I used to call it my Darth Vader machine.
Oh, what are your Darth Vader machine?
Yeah, and so I have to sit on the couch with a mask, and it's so loud because, mm-hmm. we used to have a really old one. They have much nicer ones now, but because it was way back when, it's basically this box that's next to you, and it just hums so loud that you can't hear a TV. So, like, Christine looks so upset right now.
I mean, just so sad for a little kid.
It's like, it's too loud to watch TV.
I couldn't watch TV, so, like, I had to read books. And it was super cute because my mom used to make my sister Zoe sit next to me and read books with me. And for a while, Zoe didn't like to read. And I think it was because of that.
It's like Darth Vader read to me growing up.
Yeah, but, yeah, definitely. I think that's probably one of the main reasons. It's because I kind of, like, had to sit there and read.
So going back to the thing about cable, that, like, cable was this treat, mm-hmm. what did you think about money growing up?
I think it's interesting. My parents, so growing up, my dad was a carpenter. So he was making good money most of the time, because carpenters actually make very good money.
They do.
And my mom was a nanny, like, with a nanny outside of her home, like, bringing kids into the home. Again, just bringing people in.
Mm-hmm. Mom is a saint.
And then she was, like, a nanny specifically for this family. And the woman that she basically nannied for, they ended up becoming, like, best friends. It was kind of awesome. But my dad would switch jobs sometimes, and my mom, obviously being a nanny, wasn't 100% all the time. So we would kind of go through phases of being great, and then phases where it was like my parents would basically tell us, like, we're not spending a lot of money this week. Like, that's right. What they would tell us. So, but at the same time, like, even though I know my parents had stretches where we were not doing very well, they never made us, like, feel like we couldn't afford something if we wanted to do something kind of fun. Like, they might say, like, well, we're not going to do that today, but it was never like, we can't do that because we don't have any money. It was just like, no, we're just not going to do that today. We're going to do something a little cheaper. And I guess when I was a kid, I never really thought about it because, you know, my parents just kind of took care of everything. And I started realizing it when I got older that maybe the money was a little stretched more thin than I realized. Because at one point when we were living in Richmond, Virginia, we were living in a 2-bedroom apartment with 4 kids.
That's a lot.
Yeah. two parents. Yeah. It was not like that for a while. My little sister Vivian was just born, and right. my parents were like, we gotta do something else. But fun story off of that, actually, because we needed basically a place to go because our landlord, like, upped our rent, that we had to end up moving out of that apartment. And my parents have always rented, so that was kind of interesting growing up, like, your parents being like, can we make rent this month? It was interesting.
As opposed to having a mortgage.
Yeah, yeah. Exactly. They still rent. They've never owned a house, but I think once we all move out, they're going to do it, and I really hope they do.
Your parents just do everything, like, on their own scale. Like, yeah. They just got married last year.
They did.
After, like, being together for, like, 25 or 26 years,
yeah,
or something.
They just kind of do everything at their own pace. They're like, the rest of the world's like, you should do this. And they're like, nah.
No, we're doing it our way.
Yeah, but actually, an interesting story. When we moved out of that apartment, because we were looking for a new place to go, we actually ended up moving to Church Hill, in Richmond, which is a very historic area. Back then, it was a little bit of a sketchy area, but it's a lot nicer now. We ended up moving in with this woman who had this gorgeous house there that was filled with junk, basically. And she was like, told my dad, because my dad was a carpenter, they met somehow, and she was like, hey, if you clean this house out for me and, like, make it beautiful, make it so that it would be worth a lot of money because it was a gorgeous house. It was just very run down. She was like, you and your family can live here rent-free. And so my parents were like, yeah. And so they like threw us in the car, drove us up to Churchill. And we started living there. Yeah. And so we lived there. And that house was very beautiful because my dad basically cleaned it out before we moved in. So it was just this like gorgeous house. It was like two stories, just one of those really old like Richmond apartments with like the big staircase and everything. And it was nice. But then while we were living there, my parents started to realize that the woman who had invited us to live with her, back then, we did not know what a hoarder was. That was before the show. Nobody knew what a hoarder was. They didn't realize it was a psychological condition. So we were living this woman who was basically a hoarder. And she was the sweetest woman ever. Like, she took us in, and she was sweet to all of us. She, like, took us all out on our birthdays and stuff. Aww. But my parents started to realize, like, we were never going to clean this house out because she would just keep bringing stuff in.
I see.
And so my parents, we basically, like, had to split. But that was interesting, living with a hoarder for a year.
Yeah. It's interesting, too, to hear about you. So the reason I asked the money question is because it comes up a lot in your writing that you have this sort of, you write a lot about your family, but you also write, like, I think to use your words, like, about the shitty house you grew up in, or, like, the shitty series of houses, and in the process of becoming a writer for you and sort of embracing your writerly identity was really delving into that identity of being someone that your parents lived in rented houses, and that is an aspect of who you are.
Yeah, no, it is. I'm honestly, like, I talk to my friends who lived in like the same house their whole lives or like and stuff like that, and it sounds very nice, but we did move around quite a bit, not a ton, but the house that we're living in now, or my parents are living in now, is the longest we've ever lived in a place, and they're going on 9 years there. But before that, I think the longest we'd ever lived in a place was 4 years. And I actually kind of liked moving around. Like, I was excited about moving when we moved to a new place because it's like new neighborhood, like we got to like do a new bedroom and stuff like
that. You get to just like designing your bedroom as a kid is this whole fun thing.
Yeah, exactly. So it was actually kind of cool. Like, I'm sure I was not as cool about it when I was younger, but looking back on it, like, definitely no regrets. Like, and my parents have asked us about it, like, since then, especially me and my sister Zoe, since my younger siblings have spent the majority of their life in this same house in a cul-de-sac in the suburbs. But me and my sister Zoe, we remember living in the city and stuff. And my parents have asked me, and Zoe, I think at some points, they were like, yeah, we kind of put you guys through some stuff. At one point, my mom apologized for making us live with the hoarder, and we were like, Mom, no, like, you were doing what you had to do. Like, you guys, they were kind of young when they had me, and, like, you know, I basically told them, like, no regrets. We had a lot of fun, like, moving around and stuff, so.
How have your perceptions of money changed since moving to Brooklyn?
They've definitely changed because, when I graduated VCU, I was fortunate enough to immediately get a job where I was getting paid a salary and I was making a lot of money and I wasn't used to that.
That was back in Virginia.
Yeah, that was back in Virginia. Right after I graduated college, I got a job that was salaried, benefits, like the whole nine.
The dream.
Wow. And yeah, it was, my parents were just like, the hell?
did we raise you for this?
No, my parents are totally the parents that they would rather all of us quit our jobs and work on our art. They want us to have jobs. They do. But no, my mom really, like, when I was moving to New York, my mom was like, that's so exciting. Like, but she actually, like, was pushing me to go do what my friend Maya is doing. My friend Maya is in Chile right now teaching English, and my mom was kept, like, when I was sitting at my job, like, this job where I was working the 9 to 5, I had good benefits, I, like, was getting a good salary job, my mom was emailing me links to, like, travel the world.
Oh, my gosh. Go to China.
Really, Mom, I'm trying to do this thing.
Yeah, here. I was like, it was kind of nice to be steady for a second, but at the same time, so I had that job, it was a great job, the boss was pretty tough. He was a tough boss. It took me a while to like that job. But I could have definitely moved up in this company and stuff. But I just get that from my parents where we just kind of get antsy. Mm-hmm. And I was like, no, I got to go. Like, I got a good thing going here, but I've got to go to New York.
Did you feel like it was inevitable that you had moved to Brooklyn?
A little bit, yeah. I think my mom thought it was inevitable, too.
Do you want to explain a little bit about your mom's relationship with Brooklyn?
Yeah. Okay, so my mom moved up here after college, just like I did. Me and my mom went to the same college. Yeah, there's a lot of parallel with me and my mom's life. So my mom, basically my mom graduated VCU for theater. She obviously wanted to move to New York because she wanted to be a movie director. And so she moved here, and then my dad... her boyfriend at the time.
Yeah, you know, moved, this guy she was like hanging with.
Moved with her, and they had been together for a while though, and they were like, they were very committed to each other, and basically she got pregnant with me while they were living here, and so they decided like, no, we're gonna move back to Richmond because it's a better place to like raise a kid, and they both loved Richmond so much, and so they moved back. So my mom actually had not been back to even visit New York until the first time she took me when I was after I graduated college.
Like, because it was too painful for her to go back?
Or? I'm not really sure. I think, well, I mean, like, she's got four kids, like, a full-time job. I think she was super excited when I basically told her I really want to go to New York and I want you to come with me. Like, obviously, like, if I'm going to go to New York, it's going to be with my mom because she knows it and, like, it's got to be a thing for us. So, and she was super excited. Like, she had her whole day planned out, and she was like, we're going to go here and here. And I had told her that I wanted to move somewhere else because I was at this job where I was doing really well, but I was getting a little antsy. It wasn't what I wanted to do.
What was it? I'm so curious.
I was working as an office manager at a workers' comp office for a hospital.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, boring. Solid job. Important job.
Important job.
Like, boring.
Like, literally, if I had that job, my mom would be like, that's so good when you buy the house.
Yeah. No, it really was like I would just sit there talking with these people in the office who are all awesome people. But there's one girl in the office who's about to buy a house. And then my boss kept talking about how I needed to, like, start investing my money. And, like, it was all this adult stuff. And I was like, no, I'm just going to move to New York. And, like, just be responsible.
Yeah, you were 22.
Yeah, no, I was so young. And all the people I was working with were much older than me. And they were all, like, kind of, like, they weren't, like, way old. I think one of the women there was, like, 27. But she was, like, about to buy a house and stuff like that. And I was like... Yeah, I'm not. But so I'd mentioned to my mom that I wanted to move somewhere. I was considering California.
I didn't realize that.
Yeah, I was just considering it just because I really wasn't sure about New York yet because I'd never visited. And I'd also never visited California, but I was
but
like...
what pushed you? Why New York?
New York? Oh, definitely because my mom took me up here. And I was walking around and I was like, this place is pretty awesome.
That's literally how I felt when I first came to New York. I was like, this'll do.
Yeah, I literally stepped off the bus and was like, yep, I'm good with this. And so while we were in New York, me and my mom and my sister Zoe came with us. We were all sitting at a bar, like, just drinking wine, and I was just kind of looking around, and my mom was looking at me like, what you thinking? And I was
like it.
I think I want to move here. And she was like, really? And I was like, yeah. And she was like, yes! She's like, that's so exciting! So yeah, after like visiting here once, I was like, yeah, I think I'm gonna do it.
Well, and especially as an English major, it makes sense.
You
would come to New York.
Of course, yeah. And the other thing that really pushed me here is I do really want to work in publishing and editing, which I haven't moved over to yet, but I'm planning on to next year. And this is the place to do it. Here, and like I was also looking at Boston and Chicago too. But
don't leave us.
So cold.
Yeah, so cold.
Oh yeah, because
so
it's not snowing outside right now, guys.
It's colder than
Boston.
No, it is. It is colder. No, and also my mom, growing up, did tell me she basically told me everybody, if they can, should live in New York at some point in their life because it is an experience.
Do you agree with that?
I agree with it. I've met people, actually, I have a lot of friends that I'd be like, yeah, don't do it. I don't think you can handle it. I have quite a few friends that, not that they were like, I want to do it. Because if anybody, I have a lot of friends that say, I want to do it where I couldn't see them living here. But I'm like, yeah, dude, move up here. Like, let's go.
Yeah.
But I do have some friends that have said, like, I don't really see myself in New York. And I'm like, no, I don't see you in New York either. And it's nothing to do with them. They're people that are like, they need to be near the nature, which I totally get. That can be kind of hard to find here sometimes.
Or they just need a slower pace.
Exactly.
And not all the stress of making really high rent
every month. And a lot of those friends are also people who are still trying to figure themselves out. Yeah. And I know a lot of people who like wouldn't want to spend this amount of rent start figuring yourself out.
Do you think it's easy to lose yourself in New York that way?
I think it is. Yeah, I think it can be. I know that since I've moved here and visited Richmond, Virginia, which is like my childhood home, it's all nostalgia there, and I still really love my friends, but I do realize, I don't really realize it until I go home how much I've changed up here.
Interesting.
I probably couldn't even put like a specific label on what's changed, but it's definitely made me a little tougher. I think I yelled someone in Richmond because I was crossing the street and they weren't stopping at the stop sign.
Oh my gosh.
And I yelled at them.
Why are you so angry?
I know. And I was like, oh, I'm just used to just having to give drivers a dirty look sometimes.
I'm an assertive woman. Deal with it.
I was like slamming. Here. I was just like slamming like the hood of cars sometimes. I'm walking.
That was probably the first like real New York moment I had. Oh, really? I just like witnessing something though was I was leaving my work because I did get a job like as soon as I moved up here, so I was like already thrown into like this office setting again, which was very intense. And when I was walking, I was leaving work, I'd probably only been here like a month, I saw this guy crossing the street and this taxi basically completely cut him off. And it was this guy who was like in a business suit, like dressed very well, he was a big guy, but like business suit, briefcase, and he punched the taxi like as it was driving by. He just like punched the back of it. Oh, and I was like, I just saw that dude in a business suit punch a taxi. And I was just like, I love this city.
Yeah, it really feels like sometimes when people come to New York, actually my friend, not this Christine, another Christine that I know said this, that you get to New York and you kind of have that experience where New York is like, you don't owe me, or like, I don't owe you anything.
Yeah.
Like, either you say, okay, I'm sorry, and you leave, or you're like, oh yeah, New York? Oh yeah?
No, that's true. I agree with that. I saw a shirt actually online, because you know they have those I Heart New York shirts that everyone has. I saw one that says, I have a love-hate relationship with New York.
Probably and I was more
like,
honest.
Yeah, I was like, ooh, that's very true.
What do you feel like your love-hate relationship with New York is?
I mean, it's kind of a little bit of the of the same thing, like either basically just how many people there are here and how they all interact with each other. Like, okay, so the other day, a part of my job now as an admin working at this financial company is I do have to go to Connecticut sometimes. And so I was coming back from Connecticut, this just happened the other day, and we were trying to leave the Metro North train. And we were literally just trying to get off the platform, and the people who were coming to get on our train that was going back to Connecticut were just not moving. And they just like were trying to get on the train, and I was trying not to be that person that's like, fucking Connecticut people, but like I was seriously like, no, this is, you have to wait till we get off. There was a point where we literally stood there for like 3 minutes because we couldn't move. Because these people were like bottlenecking us, so there was like hundreds and hundreds of people trying to get off this train.
Worst nightmare.
And like, yeah, and it was just, and that's, those are the moments where I'm like, I hate this city.
No, I have to admit,
there's too many people.
That's one of the few things I actually miss about the DC area. Like, people know you walk on the right, you stand on the right side of the escalator, you walk on the left side.
Yeah, people don't give a shit here.
You get off the train, then you get on the train.
Like, yeah. I kept trying to tell myself, I was like, these are Connecticut people. No. They don't know.
These poor Connecticut people.
I know. They were, and I felt really bad because some of them looked terrified because as they were walking down, like, the side of the train, everyone was giving them the dirtiest looks.
Yeah.
Like, really?
Really Connecticut?
Really? And some of these people had kids, and they were just like, we're just trying to get on the train. And I felt really bad because I was like, no, not okay.
Yeah.
But at the same time, in terms of, like, what I love about New York is I do love how many people there are and just watching the mentality of people, like, when things happen, like, on the subway. I've seen people completely not care when something happens that any of my friends from Richmond would be like, whoa, like, and they're just like, yeah, whatever, happens all the time. But at the same time, like, you know, like, I was on the subway and this woman, like, passed out, she fell over, she was standing and completely fell over, and like everybody rushed to her aid, like three people got up and like helped her, and like we got off the train and they gave her food and water and stuff like that. So it's like interesting how people in New York can just be like, I do not give a shit about you. But then at the same time, I've seen them just, like, rush to action faster than I've seen, like, any other people rush to action. It's kind of interesting.
New Yorkers are very cold hands, warm heart.
Yeah, no, agreed, yeah. I would agree with that. So that's kind of my love-hate relationship is, like, the people here I hate, but at the same time, the people here are awesome. So.
How do you think living in New York has changed the way you write your stories? If at all.
No, actually, that's really interesting. So when I was living in Richmond, I was doing my writing, and I took this absolutely fantastic poetry class with David Wojahn.
Oh, he's the best!
He is amazing. Like, shout out to David Wojahn. You are amazing.
No, he's the best.
One of the greatest poets ever, and probably one of the best teachers I've ever had.
Yeah, totally.
Just will really, like, look at your poetry and be like, nah. And I love teachers like that because, especially with my poetry, I would write poetry in classes that weren't really, like, poetry, or they were just, like, technically creative classes. Mm-hmm. Or I would take a poetry class with, it was more, like, supportive and comforting and just be like, you've talked about some really real shit there, so I'm just gonna tell you that that
good
was awesome
job.
Exactly. But with him, he was just like, I think this is like kind of juvenile.
Yeah. I was like, you're like, oh
okay, yeah. Like, I left my first like sit down session with him kind of wanting to cry, but also being like, I know what I need to do now.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, it's really fascinating.
He treats you like you are his peer.
Yeah, no, he really does.
In a way that is, like, intimidating but inspiring.
Yeah, no, exactly. So, taking his class, I really got my poetry to, like, a place I was really happy with, like, under his teaching. And then the kids in the class were also amazing poets that just gave me really, really great feedback. So I was getting to my poetry to a place that I really liked it. And I was noticing that my best writing was about my childhood and about my family and stuff like that. And but then when I moved to New York, honestly, I kept writing about that. And I started actually focusing more on Richmond since I left it, kind of like a nostalgia thing. So I did more writing on Richmond, but I got to look at Richmond not living there anymore and not being in it, and kind of how now that I live in a different city, a city that's completely different. And Richmond's a little bubble.
Yep.
Like, it's the sweetest place ever, but like, it's very little bubble. And when you're living there, you don't really notice certain things, like really how cute it is there, basically.
Yeah,
how the people
absolutely.
There are so sweet and everything's so cheap, and like,
oh, yeah.
It's kind of like,
do you want to pay $300 for your own bedroom?
Go to Richmond. And yeah, so after moving out of that into this place where like people really don't give a shit about you that much, it was kind of cool looking back on this place and writing about it from that perspective, like in New York, looking back on living in Richmond. It was pretty cool.
Side note, so David Wojahn, I was in a class of, just like, this is my only, I'll only tell one story. But there's a girl in my class who straight up wrote a poem about Mulan, the Disney movie, and David Wojahn, like, to his credit, didn't even go like, girl, did you just write a poem about Mulan, the Disney movie? Like, he was just like, let's read it on the terms that it is set for the poem. And like, he was like, this doesn't work, that doesn't work, this is good. He just was like, yeah, here's how we're going to assess this poem about a Disney movie.
Yeah. No, yeah, he's awesome, yeah.
Go Rams. Go Rams.
So what do you miss about Richmond the most, you think?
The rents.
I was about to say that you can have a bedroom at $300 a month.
Yeah, I was living in a 3-bedroom apartment with 2 awesome girls who I'm still friends with. We were living in a really nice area in Richmond in the Fan, which is a very nice area. And we had a balcony, and I was paying $350 a month.
What?
It's just, my favorite thing to do is to tell people who are from New York that. Because
yeah,
they're so mad. They're just like, what the hell?
In like a nice place,
and
too.
Yeah.
Not like a dumpster fire.
Yeah, I'm like, no, this is like a nice place. I was right around the block from like this really great bar. Like, mm-hmm. you know, and there was, like, tons of bars in the area, and it's like, I think I'm going to end up destroying Richmond because I'm just going to keep telling New Yorkers how awesome it is, and they're just all going to move there.
Yeah, no, like, once the L goes down, Brooklynites are going to go move to Richmond. I don't doubt it.
No, actually, my parents say that there is actually is a huge connection with Brooklyn and Richmond.
Yeah,
yeah, because when they moved back to Richmond, a lot of their friends that they knew in New York moved to Richmond, and there is just, like, a huge connection with it. Honestly, when me and my boyfriend, who I moved here with, he and I went to a bar for the first time in Brooklyn. Like, we were living in South Brooklyn, but I was like, I hear North Brooklyn's cool.
Before
I was like, this area seems cool. When we went up to Williamsburg to this bar that is actually a great bar. And
it was a trophy bar?
It was Sugarberg.
Oh, Sugarberg.
Whiskey bar. Yeah. And so I went there, literally the first bar I ever went into in New York, like, since I'd moved here. We walk in, we sit down, and the bartender is just this standard jolly Williamsburg fellow. Oh. Big guy with, like, a big beard and just super friendly. And we sit up and we're like, hey, can we get some beers? And he's like, yeah, let me see your ID. So we show him our IDs, and we still have our Virginia IDs at this point. And he was like, you guys from Richmond? And we were like, yeah. And he was like, I'm from Richmond. And I was like, aww. Now, granted, he'd moved to New York 10 years ago, so okay. He was like, what's it like now? Because he was like, okay. It was kind of shit. No, he was like, it was kind of shitty when I left.
Oh,
and I was like, no. It's really nice now, like VC, and we were basically like, VC is just kind of like taking over a big chunk of it, which is not always the best thing. But
VCU thinks it's the best thing, but VCU can be mistaken.
Well, yeah, I remember when VCU came out with that shirt that said, "We built this city."
Oh.
I was like, "Sit down, sir."
Oh.
It was really bad. I was like, "That is no."
I know you haven't been in New York that long, mm-hmm. but what observations do you have about gentrification so far?
I feel like it's hard for me to talk about this as a gentrifier.
No, we all are.
Yeah.
Like earlier this month, we had that conversation.
Yeah, I definitely feel like I am. I have moved into a neighborhood where the people there have lived there for a very long time. Actually, there was this woman I met there named, her name's Matza, but she told me I could call her grandma. She's the sweetest
lady
ever.
Wait, her name is Matza?
Matza.
Like the Jewish flatbread.
I think she said, she has a very strong accent. I felt really bad. I couldn't quote, but I've called her Matza, and she's like been like, yeah.
Okay. She's accepted that pronunciation.
Right, she's cool, accepted cool. that pronunciation for me, but she's very, I usually call her grandma though. And she's like lived in Brooklyn like 85 years.
Damn.
But what? She's, yeah, like, but she's so sweet because she was like, welcome to the neighborhood. Mm. Like, and then she told me that the building I'm living in now used to be a bodega. And I was like, I'm sorry.
Sorry that you like that
sorry.
Bodega.
And she was like, yeah, that was like one of my favorite bodegas. And but she did. She said she moved here 85 years ago. She said she did live actually in Virginia for a little bit. Because when she asked where I was from, I said from Richmond, Virginia. She was like, I lived in Norfolk for a while.
Oh, bless.
And but she was like, yeah, I can't. When I moved back, like the bodega was gone. I was like,
oh,
yeah.
How old is she?
She's older.
She's like 100.
She's definitely got to be in like her late 80s, early 90s.
Ooh.
But she's very sweet, and it was very sweet of her to like welcome me to the neighborhood and just be very friendly. But at the same time, like, I know that it's not like that for everybody. Like, just be like, welcome to the neighborhood. Like, because I go to a bar that's definitely like this little gentrified spot where if you actually look at Google Maps of the area, that bar is not there.
Really?
It's very new.
Okay.
And so I don't know, I just kind of have mixed feelings on it because I know that it's bad, that it's doing bad things, it's pushing people out, but at the same time I'm living in like a really cool area, so I just feel bad living there like as a gentrifier, but at the same time, I've met some really cool people in that area, people that have actually lived there a very long time, but you just have to realize, like, to be a person living in that situation, you do have to be very aware of what it can be doing to the people around you.
And to engage with your neighbors like you do mm-hmm. is important.
Yeah.
To say hello, to introduce mm-hmm. yourself
yeah.
is important. Oh, that's like the bare minimum.
To be fair, I was walking down the street. I was going to blow right past her. Not to be mean. I said good morning. And then she stopped me and was like, oh, hi, welcome to the neighborhood. And I was like, oh, aww. Thank you. Like, so
aww.
To be fair, I always say hello to everybody in my neighborhood and stuff like that because I think that is important. Like, you don't have to like be best friends with them, but You should definitely say hello, and if they mm-hmm. want to talk, you know, stop and have a conversation with them, because I've had some conversations with her, and she just kind of hangs out outside, just looking to talk to people. Yeah. And I also feel like for her, she's lived here 85 years, she's probably used to sitting on her porch and just talking to the people in the neighborhood.
Yeah.
You know? And then nowadays, we're all just, like, walking down the street with our headphones in, which I do that. Like, I totally get... Yeah. And that's just kind of... That's probably just got to suck a little bit. You're just, like, kind of just want to talk to people in the neighborhood, and everyone's just, like, going to their subway stop.
Yeah, I mean, if you were born in a time before TV,
yeah,
certainly well before the internet,
yeah,
and iPods and all that.
But yeah,
can we talk a little bit about feminism? Before?
Yeah,
I mean, like
favorite topic.
holding my guns and my rosters.
I wanted to know if you've always identified as a feminist. If New York, living in New York, has changed your identity as a feminist or as a strong woman at all.
I'm going to be completely honest. When I was not, like, super young, I was at a point where I didn't want to identify as a feminist because of what it meant.
Oh, same.
Because of, like, the connotation of that. Only because I had been told by men in my life that being a feminist wasn't cool.
Mm.
Not my dad or my brother or anything like that. Like, they're very supportive, but just, like, boys that I knew.
Boys.
That were just, like, it's not... It's, like, this whole thing with it. Like, it's just man-haters and, like... And I really did, like... At a young age, I was like, I believed in all the things that feminists believed. I just had issue with the name because it had a bad connotation to it. And then I went to VCU and realized that that's total bullshit. Being an effect.
Like, try to get to, like, 18 and a half at VCU and, like, not be like, wait a minute. Oh, this is awesome.
This is, like, oh, totally okay. And people that are like, you're a feminist, it's, like, not worth your time. I'm sorry, but you're not. Like, if you have that much difficulty with a word... Sorry, like...
Sucks to suck.
I did have a lot of issue when, like, becoming a feminist and taking that name and being like, I am a feminist. I did have issue with women that I knew who were feminists that did say some very hateful things about men. Yeah. That, like...
And it's a thing we don't always talk about in feminism.
And I just had a lot of issue. And obviously, since I've learned more, I realize that is not always the case, definitely. But I think that was one of the things that I noticed when I was becoming a feminist. And I think it's a thing that makes a lot of people kind of hesitant to move into it.
How do you think we talk about that then? Because I think that something that it is important. Like, it's just saying, like, oh, feminism isn't about hating men, which is absolutely true.
Yeah, no, it's not.
But that doesn't mean that people who identify as feminists don't have some very real and often legitimate anger
at men. I think that there's a difference between hate and anger.
Ooh, I like that.
I know women that have spoken very angrily about things that men have done, but they pinpointed to specific situations and stuff like that, or, like... So, I guess the best way to do this, to kind of talk about that, would be, honestly, in just specific instances in the day-to-day. So, when I was at VCU, I took a women's women's reading class, basically. It was a feminist literature class where we only read books by women.
With Liz Canfield?
No, it was with Gretchen Komba.
Oh, she's awesome, too.
She's amazing. She just published a book, by the way.
Shout out.
I bought it. It's on my reading list. But when we were in the classroom, she was aware that she was with young women who were feminists, a lot of whom were very angry and had obviously gone through some stuff. And we had, I think, 3 or 4 men in the class. And she made it very apparent on the first day. She was like, this is what we're going to talk about, all this stuff. And then she just kind of did a side note. She was like, side note, we are not going to make the men in this room feel like that they are not welcome here. And was basically like, we are going to discuss our angers, and we are going to discuss the literature and what it means. But, like, I will not allow you to just sit here and make blanket statements, basically. It was interesting. And it was a very interesting class. I think there were instances where women did say some very angry things, but she let that happen because she realized that they needed to get something out. But But I guess the best way I can kind of what I've said to men who have said to me that they cannot identify as a feminist because of that aspect of it, which is just at this point, it's not true. Like it's right. You can identify as it. But Gloria Steinem said that we're all most people are victims of the patriarchy, not just women.
Right.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
And I think when I talk to men about that, it makes it feel a little more inclusive, and it kind of sucks because I'm like, it's not about you, though. Yeah. Like, I hate that I had to make this about you for you to listen to me.
Right.
And that's an issue that I have. But no, that is probably one of my favorite Gloria Steinem quotes.
She's so great. I mean, obviously. But I think that's really crucial that at some point, I feel like the men in my life who are feminists, they do have that turning point mm-hmm. where they realize, like, oh, they're... Because when... I feel like when you're a woman and you're, like, 19 or 20, you go through this phase, you're like, oh, my gosh, everything I've been told my whole life is a lie, and mm-hmm. I don't have to be this sweet, docile girl. I can be my own person. And maybe for men, that happens a little bit later, because it's not... It seems, like, on the surface that they have everything they could want, and then mm-hmm. slowly over time, a little bit later into their 20s, they realize, like, oh, there are things that are not just barring the women in my life for mm-hmm. experiencing their full potential, but there are things that I thought were just natural things about being a man that are not true. It's mm-hmm. all constructed.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I mean, the way our society defines masculinity, mm-hmm. the way so many parents don't let their little boys express emotions. They don't let little boys cry.
Yeah.
They don't let little boys say, I'm sad, I'm hurt, I don't want someone to touch me or talk to me mm-hmm. that way.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. No, definitely. Yeah, and I also think a reason that it can be difficult for a man to identify as a feminist is to get to that point to be able to observe the world around you in that lens. For women, they have been observing it that way their entire lives. Not from the feminist viewpoint, but like, this is happening to me, and feeling like it's kind of out of your control, and just feeling victimized a lot and stuff like that. But for men, it kind of, they have to check the privilege, basically. And mm-hmm. that is not always easy to do.
Yeah.
And they need to do it, but I think for men to get to that point, it's a lot of, like, looking at themselves and how they interact with the world, and it's difficult for people to do, not just men, but for people to do.
Yeah, no, definitely. It's hard for us all to do, but I agree with what you're saying, that women have had to look at the world through this different lens, and so for us, it's like, we have to learn how to do it early for survival's sake, and if you don't have to do it for survival, then it's a lot harder It's hard to it's harder to unlearn things than it is to learn things.
Yeah. Agreed.
So one of the organizations that you participate in is, what is it, Women, the meeting that we went to recently after Trump was elected.
I'm trying to remember the name now. Now I feel really bad. National Women's Liberation.
Yes.
Actually going to one of their meetings on Tuesday.
Really?
Yeah, they are doing another meeting. After the election, National Women's Liberation basically had like a reactionary meeting. They said they had the highest numbers that they've ever seen at one of their meetings. They had to, at the last minute, change their venue from like an event space to a big event space.
Oh my God.
And they had to shut the doors at one point because the building was getting at capacity. Mm-hmm. There were women in every single seat and lining the walls and sitting on the ground. And then the women who were unfortunately not allowed to enter, they actually ended up going to a park across the street and having their own meeting.
Wow.
And then other women who couldn't get in, we were live streaming the meeting, and or they were live streaming the meeting, and they actually went to a bar and watched the live stream.
Hmm.
So it was really interesting. All the people who work or who do that organization were very blown away by it. And at that point, we discussed the Women's March that's happening the day after the inauguration, and we discussed...
Is that still happening?
That is still happening.
Is it?
Yeah.
Suck it, Trump. because that was, everyone was barred from protesting because we don't live in a dictatorship or anything.
Yeah. I think what happened was that basically the Inauguration Committee this is from the most recent article I read, so this might not be true now, but the inauguration committee and the Park Service were not giving anyone permits yet just because the inauguration committee has not set everything in stone yet. Like, they don't know what parts of the mall they're going to use.
Right.
But they have said, we are going to allow people to protest.
Okay.
They have to.
Yeah. And then also...
I don't even know what's on the table anymore, like, what we're allowed to do. I think a lot of stuff is up for grabs now in a way that it wasn't last month.
Yeah, exactly. And then even just looking at the Facebook page for the Women's March... all of these women, because there was a lot of information out there saying that they weren't going to let us protest, and all these people were like, well, like, that's not...
Guess what?
And so when all that was going out, all of these people were like, yeah, I bought a plane ticket already, so I'm going, like, at this point. Like,
totally.
Like, that's great that we didn't get our permit, but, or we didn't get the, you know, permit in the area that we wanted, but we're still going to go.
Yeah.
Like, you know, maybe we're not allowed in this area, and we can respect that, but, like...
Cannot use the master's tools to dismantle the master's house.
Exactly. Nice.
I took some feminism classes in college too. I don't know what I'm about.
But anyway, so the I want to say their name correctly. I think it's the National Women's Liberation, like, group movement.
Yeah, because they're like the original. Like,
they're
consciousness raising.
Yeah, they were the consciousness raising. They actually were the ones that got Plan B. From behind the counter, basically. Like,
right,
now
so you don't have
shelf.
To stand in front of the pharmacist and be like, can I...
And be judged.
Can I please have that? Oh, I've hardcore sent some boys in. Be like, you started this, you are the one, bring back a donut.
Yeah, and so they're the ones that did that. One of the women at the meeting, who I just went up to afterwards, and I was like, I need to meet you. Mm-hmm. She got arrested for... blocking the doors to the one of the FDA buildings in protest. I think they chained the doors. I don't know what they did, but they were basically like, the FDA is not allowed to spread falsehoods about this pill, and so she actually got arrested for it. This is a pretty badass organization. So when I went to the meeting, I was like, I think this is an organization I really want to become involved in.
So what do you do?
So at that meeting, it was very reactionary at this point. It was basically women and how the election had affected them. There were some very real moments there. That was actually the first time I cried after the election was there. There was a woman there who had cerebral palsy.
I remember that.
Do you remember that? Because you went to this meeting with me, and she was basically talking about what it felt like to have a president who mocked her.
Yep.
And... that was very intense. There were a lot of women of color there talking about how they felt, which was really, really amazing to see. And it was very intense. At that point, it was, unfortunately, it just had to be a reactionary meeting.
Yeah.
And we did talk about the Women's March. They talked about some of the work that they want to do in terms of, you know, keeping open access to abortion. But now it's like, that was more... let's all process our feelings, and then
it was
meeting
a week.
It really was. And then the meeting on Tuesday is going to be, here's what we're doing. So I'm pretty excited for the meeting on Tuesday. Turned down a Tinder date. Keeping on Tuesday? Nope.
Keep your feminism card. You got it, girl.
But yeah.
Yeah, reactionary gets a bad rep, but I went to that meeting with you, and it was like, we all just needed to cry and listen to each other, and like, the whole philosophy between these original consciousness raisings was, everybody tell your story, and from your story we can identify patterns, and from those patterns we can make action. So I think that, I don't think there's anything negative about that being a reactionary meeting. I think that we all heard things from different kinds of women about what they were, so, like, women who, like, this was their first time they'd ever identified as a feminist was at this meeting, and they were speaking up about it. And then that woman who had cerebral palsy, or there were tons of women who were like, listen, I come from the heartland, and I'm telling you guys it's a lost cause. Or conversely, I come from the heartland, and I'm telling you guys, here's what we do.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that, I needed to hear that more than I needed to hear anything else.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much, Kaylin. We really appreciate having you on the show, behind the scenes. You've been listening to The Badass Lady Folk of Brooklyn. I'm Christine Stoddard.
And I'm Mari Pack.
This is Radio Free Brooklyn. Tune in next week.